You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, Fox News anchor Megyn Kelly has become the story multiple times during the 2016 presidential race. We find out why some people are calling her an unlikely feminist icon.
First, a new study examines the relationship between drinking and college students of color in Wisconsin. A new study from UW-Madison's University Health Services says that campus drinking culture doesn't affect all students the same way.
Rhonda Washington joins us now to tell us more. She's the Alcohol and Drug Prevention Coordinator at University Health Services in Madison. She did a study that found that students of color are negatively impacted by campus drinking culture. Rhonda, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you decide you wanted to take a closer look at the impact of UW's drinking culture on students of color?
The idea actually came from our students. I went to talk to ASM, and they were like, do you have any data about how the alcohol culture is impacting specifically our students of color? And I started looking at research, and nothing was there. So then we decided to start the whole process that got us to color of drinking in the survey.
And you started with focus groups, right?
Yes, we did start with focus groups, specifically the Machistas, which is a Latinx subgroup on campus. We started with them, and they told us, they gave us the feedback that focus groups are not a best use of their time because as students, you're pretty busy. So they're like, if you did this as a survey that was less than 10 minutes, they would do it.
And ultimately, how many students participated?
We had about 500 students participate in the survey.
So what did you find? How are students of color impacted by UW's pretty pronounced drinking culture?
First off, 90% of them, over 90%, described it as something negative. Meaning they got the message, one that kept coming up a lot, was drink or get out. Participate in our drinking culture, get out. So then going on from there, 65% said that the drinking culture impacted their overall experience at the university. And 48% reported experiencing a microaggression from someone who was intoxicated.
When you say 65% said it, the drinking culture did impact their experience at UW, their academics, their group socialization, that kind of thing, are we assuming that it's a negative impact?
For the majority of them, they were negative impacts because I asked the simple questions as yes, no, but then had them try and explain or write their explanation. And like one student said that, you know, paraphrasing for IRB reasons, that he was treated like less of a man and he was scrutinized more because he was now being characterized as a minority of a minority because he didn't participate, and that impacted his overall going through campus.
Right, that part of it is a really interesting find in the survey because not only are students of color, they feel maybe separate a little bit because of being non-white on campus, but also it seems as though the rates of drinking are lower among students of color. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Our students of color, and this is part of another reason for us wanting to do more research about it, our students of color on our campus have the highest rates of non-drinking or abstaining, meaning they haven't had any alcohol or don't participate in the alcohol culture at all. Compared to our white students based on just alcohol EDU, 66% of our non-drinkers are students of color, as compared to the 33% of our white students that are non-drinkers.
And in terms of the overall culture of drinking at UW-Madison, as someone who works in this field, how would you describe it? How pervasive is it?
I would say we are a high-risk drinking environment. Characterize it by that, just looking at everyone, not just our first years, from our American College Health Assessment from the National College Health Association, we found that 50% of our undergraduates use alcohol at high risk, or, you know, that gets into the five or more drinks in a sitting.
And it sounds like there are also areas around campus that are, you know, if you're a student, you know this is where people go to drink. There might be a State Street is one on the main drag near campus, or Langdon Street is another area. What did you find out about those areas where students might go where people are drinking?
Well, so we asked in the color of drinking, are there areas you avoid on or off campus because of the alcohol culture? And those two came up as number one. Langdon Street was number one, with 53% of the respondents saying that they avoid Langdon Street because of overall intoxication of the people that live there, or harassment from members that they perceive or greet about their race or comments. And then they also said, secondly, State Street at 42.7%. because of the overall intoxicants, people coming out of the bars and causing problems or yelling at them as they're just walking by those areas.
We just came off the weekend leading up to Halloween, and one of the big markers of that season is Freak Fest, which happens on State Street near campus. And I'm guessing there's a lot of drinking that goes on there. Did you hear anything about how students of color may have felt or how that impacted students?
We're still getting that information back because it's now Monday, but I know that I had heard anecdotally from some of our students that students of color, that they were just planning to avoid that area in general, so that they didn't put themselves in a situation where they could be harassed, possibly.
I wonder if you could tell us some of the stories that you heard from students that illustrate the points you're making. You mentioned one, but what else did you hear? Did you hear anything that surprised you?
Well, it's just for a lot of our students, like talking about how it's impacted their academics, for example, our drinking culture, where, you know, either they feel that they are obligated to join and participate to fit in, to drink, and they'll overdo it and they can't go to class, or those students who are in class who don't drink, but having things said to them by their professors or their TAs, or having to schedule their group around the drinking holidays because their group work, because everyone has to do group work in college, you know, students are choosing to drink, and so that makes it harder to do the group work. But then there's also, like, just the plain microaggressions, which, again, I'm paraphrasing some of them, so, you know, like, sexual harassment, racial harassment, like 30% of what students reported in the survey were, you know, just harassment based on their appearance or their assumed appearance, meaning people would just sometimes just say racist comments straight to their face, or the asking of, where are you from, or mocking the language that they assumed or thought they spoke, you know, or there was one student who was simply just doing their laundry in a residence hall, and someone basically paraphrased and told them that that was all they were good for, was doing laundry, and they described that experience as the most degrading they have ever felt on university property.
Rhianda Washington is with us right now. She's the Alcohol and Drug Prevention Coordinator at UW-Madison's University Health Services. And she's joining us to talk about a new study looking at the relationship between students of color and the alcohol culture on campus at UW-Madison. And I wonder, what are some of the recommendations that you have for students and staff after doing this study?
I think it's looking at some of the health impacts our campus climate has, and not just trying to do, you know, one or the other. It's, you have to address both. And we have been taking steps to address both, but sort of making sure that we know, like, even from the Real UW tweets, which I analyzed, that one out of every five of those Real UW tweets, students reported alcohol was the aggressor in their harassment that they received while on campus or adjacent to campus. So looking at solutions that address both issues and not just addressing one or the other in a vacuum and hoping that they'll cancel each other out.
Looking at pop culture, we've seen, you know, this spotlight on alcohol, you know, is being fun, the frat scene, movies like Animal House. Does that survey that you've done, does it indicate that our vision of the college experience isn't really the same for everyone when it comes to that assumption about what college is about, what you do there?
I think so. And, like, what I think is really interesting about the survey I've done is that we're looking at the impacts, because everyone glorifies drinking in the college community as whether it's true or higher than what it is, but no one looks at what are the impacts of the alcohol use on students. So flipping around, whether it be non-drinkers, students of color, students in recovery, what does that look like for them navigating this environment, and how do we keep them healthy as well as, you know, honoring students' personal choice?
And very briefly as we wrap up, what do you want to look at after the study?
Well, we're planning on doing the study again in spring, coming up in spring. And we want to include, because for Color of Drinking, we just looked at students of color specifically, any student who did not identify solely as white who was an undergraduate student. So going forward, we're hoping to include some of our white students and sort of look at teasing out some of the various differences, including some of the questions that were asked in the previous survey, but also attitudes and beliefs about what things are okay or not okay in regards to alcohol use in this environment.
Rhianda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Rhianna Washington. She's the Alcohol and Drug Prevention Coordinator at UW-Madison's University Health Services. We spoke with her yesterday. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we're just a week away from the election, and candidates are making their final campaign stops in swing states like Wisconsin. We'll see what impact these visits might have on voters.
First, according to news released last night, Fox News anchor Megyn Kelly was offered a $20 million contract to stay at the network. This follows a heated election cycle during which Kelly and Republican nominee Donald Trump had a highly publicized feud.
Here's Megyn Kelly asking Trump a question at a GOP primary debate about words he's used to describe women in the past.
You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Your Twitter account
only Rosie O'Donnell.
When Trump was questioned about Megyn Kelly, his comments sparked controversy.
Gets out and she starts asking me all sorts of ridiculous questions, and you know, you could see there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever.
Weeks later, Trump took to Twitter and tweeted that the news anchor was a lightweight and later boycotted the final GOP debate that she was set to moderate on Fox News. The recent controversy has cast a new light on Megyn Kelly.
Joining us now is Emily Jane Fox, staff writer for Vanity Fair. She wrote an article called How Megyn Kelly Became an Improbable Feminist Icon. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, around the time you're writing this, I imagine, last week we saw this interview that Megyn Kelly did with former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Here's a listen. Gingrich criticizes Kelly's coverage of Republican nominee Donald Trump after allegations of sexual assault surfaced against him.
You want to go back to the tapes of your show recently? You are fascinated with sex and you don't care about public policy.
Me?
Well, that's
really
what I get out of watching you tonight.
You know what, Mr. Speaker, I'm not fascinated by sex, but I am fascinated by the protection of women and understanding what we're getting in the Oval Office. And I think the American voters would like
and
to know.
And therefore, we're going to send Bill Clinton back to the East Wing because, after all, you are worried about sexual predators.
Yeah, listen, it's not about me. It's about the women and men of America. And the poll numbers show us that the women of America in particular are very concerned about these allegations and in large part believe that they are a real issue. And
you want to comment,
you want to
comment on whether the
Clinton... summarily.
And so it goes. So you wrote about, Emily, this role of Megyn Kelly in this election. We've heard her with Donald Trump. We've heard her now with Newt Gingrich, an unlikely feminist icon, improbable feminist icon. Talk about that.
Sure. So, you know, this is supposed to be a historic election year for women. We have our first major party nominee as a woman for the first time. And probably it's Megyn Kelly who has kind of come out as the woman who's standing up for other women. We saw time and time again with Donald Trump, starting last August with the first GOP primary debate. She had stood up against his attacks and the attacks from his supporters for almost 6 months until they sat down face to face in prime time last spring. We saw it this summer again with the allegations against Fox News, former Fox News chief Roger Ailes, when Megyn reportedly cooperated with the investigation into those allegations and reportedly also supported other women she worked with coming forward. And then we saw it throughout the last couple of months. Newt Gingrich was the most recent example, but a number of people have come on her show in September and early October, including Trump campaign manager Kellyanne Conway, defending the comments that we heard Trump say about women on the Access Hollywood tapes. And Megyn has rightly said, you know, these are important things to the American people. You can't possibly defend these comments. You can't possibly say that Donald Trump is not sexist when these kinds of comments are caught on tape. He has repeatedly been caught saying them. So Megyn has really been a champion for women in an election when you wouldn't think that she would necessarily be the champion.
Yeah, why her? Why has she ended up in this role, do you think?
Well, I think some of it is timing. I don't think that she ever could have imagined that she would have asked a question that launched such a big feud at the first debate. I think she was asking a tough question, and it kind of launched into this whole media spectacle, and mostly because Donald Trump turned it into one. But I think she didn't predict that this would be her role in the election. She certainly didn't predict what happened this summer with Roger Ailes. And I think once she got started and once the seal was broken on that. It became easier for her to talk about. Look, it's difficult for a woman to stand up for other women. It shouldn't be that way, but it is. And so she got started last summer with Donald Trump. She continued that this summer with Roger Ailes. And now she's kind of found her voice on the issue and realized that it works and she gets good attention from it. She probably feels good doing it as well. So I think she's kind of gotten on a roll with it and has kept going with it.
And you and others have written that there are people who are generally not friendly with Fox News, people from the liberal side of the political spectrum, pro-Democrats, who, even though Megyn Kelly in some ways does fit into what they think of Fox News, they admire her for some of what she's been doing, in this, especially in this election campaign.
I would admire her even if she were, on an alt-right website or an alt-left website. I think what she's doing for women is very admirable, regardless of where she comes from. Anyone who's willing to stick their neck out for other women who have been assaulted or harassed or bullied, I think it's an amazing thing. And to watch a news person stop the news cycle and say, hey, wait a minute, you can't just get away with saying that about women, or you can't defend that kind of behavior. That's what all news people should do. That's our responsibility as journalists, and I think she's doing a very good job.
Now, this has been a particularly unusual year, I think, when it comes to this talk about how we talk about women in a political campaign. But do you think that things like this probably have been swept under the rug, ignored, downplayed in years past?
Yes. This is an extraordinary election because, one, we have our first female presidential candidate, and two, her opponent has been caught saying some pretty horrible things about women. And so it not necessarily been swept under the rug in past elections, but it hasn't been thrown in our faces either. It's pretty hard to ignore during this election season. I think we didn't have kind of rhetoric in elections past because the candidates didn't speak this way, at least not on camera or microphone.
Talking to Emily Jane Fox from Vanity Fair, talking about Megyn Kelly from Fox News, the role she's played in this election, and how she's impacted the conversation about women in our political system. As you mentioned, this is all coming amidst this big sexual harassment investigation at Fox News. Roger Ailes out there now. Is it weird that that the person who we're talking about as this person standing up for women came out of this setting that, at least by a lot of reports, is very hostile toward women, toward female employees there?
Well, these are all allegations. I'll say that off the bat. I think this is very true in many workplaces across the country, certainly in news, but in many industries, especially, you know, Fox News is a very appearance-driven network, as many cable networks tend to be. It's not shocking that that was the culture, but these people, these women have brains and feelings regardless of where they are, and I'm sure that many people across the country feel exactly the way Megyn feels. But many people don't have a primetime television show to express these views, and I think that's what gives her such power in this situation. She's able to say in a very public, very watched way what many women across the country and across the world are feeling, and that is what has been so tremendous to watch throughout the whole election cycle.
Unfortunately, a very common theme lately in our culture is when a woman in any forum speaks out, especially on issues related to women, there tends to be a very strong backlash. We see campaigns of internet harassment targeting people, women who speak up about diversity in gaming, just to say one example. Right. Have we seen a similar backlash outside of Donald Trump himself to Megyn Kelly and what she's done?
I think I'm not an expert on this. I think especially after the first primary debate that sparked the whole feud between Kelly and Trump, there was a lot of Twitter harassment that came Megyn's way. I remember Trump himself retweeting people calling her bimbos, and he even called her a lightweight on Twitter. I'm sure she got a fair share of harassment online. Has that continued with news? Probably, but I think she's gotten a ton of good wishes and press on the other side as well. So I'm sure it has come with a lot of good and a lot of bad on both ends of the spectrum.
When it comes to women in politics and front and center on the political stage, do you feel a sense of one step forward, one step back, or two steps back, given a lot of the reactions we've been seeing this election season?
I feel like there should be a great leap forward in this election. By all accounts, we could end up with our first female president next week, and that's a tremendous thing. That's regardless of whether or not you support her, that's a very cool moment in history to think about, and I think that's gotten sadly lost in all of this craziness of this election season. I think the saddest thing about this whole election for me is there are a lot of very accomplished women who are getting chances that they've never gotten before. You have Hillary Clinton, who's the first, you know, female nominee. You have Kellyanne Conway, who's a campaign manager. You have Ivanka Trump, who's been out there, who has a very successful career and has been the most successful surrogate for her father. You have Megyn Kelly, who's really having this moment. You have Huma Abedin, who's a very top aide to Hillary Clinton. And all of these women have been forced to answer for men behaving badly at some point or another throughout this campaign. And so while they should be experiencing this glory moment and relishing in their own success and being lavished with praise for all the things they've managed to accomplish, instead they're kind of taking on the criticism for behavior that was not their own, and instead behavior of their father or their boss or their husband or their friend. And it's just a shame for me to watch.
As we wrap up, Emily, what do you see next? What do you hope for next from Megyn Kelly herself?
Well, I think Megyn is in a tremendous position. I think she is clearly being courted by Fox and perhaps some other networks. And I think she has a book coming out next week as well called Settle for More. And I think that Megyn will settle for nothing less than what she deserves.
We'll leave it there. Emily, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Emily Jane Fox. She's a staff writer for Vanity Fair. We've been talking about her piece, How Megyn Kelly Became an Improbable Feminist Icon.
Coming up, we're only a week away from the general election, and candidates are campaigning hard in battleground states like Wisconsin. We'll learn about how effective these stops are with voters. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7 is Latino USA. In this week's edition, a look at race and the role it's playing in the 2016 election campaign. That's coming up tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, as we inch closer to Election Day next Tuesday, the candidates are making their final cases to voters before they cast their ballots. While candidates are keen to make speeches and be seen making appearances at party events, one tried and true method of drumming up interest is to campaign in swing states like Wisconsin.
Republican candidate Donald Trump is visiting Eau Claire today in his 6th campaign stop here in the state since the GOP convention this summer.
But while his Democratic challenger, Hillary Clinton, has sent several surrogates to Wisconsin, including an appearance by her former challenger Bernie Sanders tomorrow, she herself has not visited the state since before the April primary.
But what impact do these appearances, or lack thereof, have on voters, and how strategic do candidates have to be with their visits, with their time, especially when the campaigns are in a fever pitch leading up to Election Day?
Joining us now to talk about the impact candidates' visits can have on voters is Mike Wagner. He's an associate professor of journalism and mass communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
As we mentioned earlier, Donald Trump has visited the state several times. He'll be here speaking again. And noting that, what do you see as his game plan here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think he really needs to work on consolidating the Republican base. If you look at the Marquette Law poll from nearly a month ago, Senator Johnson has almost every Republican in the state saying, yes, I'm voting for Ron Johnson. And Donald Trump does not have that same set of numbers on his side of the ledger in terms of Republicans. And so I think he keeps returning, hoping to spur more Republican support. And this time, at least in some of the reporting I've seen, he'll have some other Republicans from Wisconsin with him, which is relatively new for him when he comes to the state. So there's more of a unity sort of feel to this. And there's also a kind of a signal to Republican voters who are wayward from Trump to come home and vote for their side, I imagine is his goal coming in to these last few days. days.
All right. As you said, he lost the primary here, lost it to Ted Cruz. And tonight, for the first time, it sounds like he'll have Senator Ron Johnson beside him. So do you think that will be something that, that will sway voters who, as you said, might be looking for a reason to come home?
I think if you're a Republican who is for Johnson and has not been for Trump yet, that kind of thing might make a difference at the margin to say, okay, well, Johnson's convinced or Governor Walker's convinced or whoever, that can matter a little bit in terms of, you know, someone you trust vouching for a candidate that you might be skeptical of. And as you point out, you know, Trump didn't win Wisconsin, neither did Hillary Clinton, for that matter, in the primaries. But she's consolidated the Democratic base in a way that he hasn't. And so he needs all the help he can get from all the surrogates he can muster in the Badger State.
We're going to get another Marquette Law School poll tomorrow, but do you have any sense about how Republicans in the state are feeling about Donald Trump? We heard a lot initially about southeastern Wisconsin and that being a particularly tough area for Donald Trump. What do you think about where we are now?
I think that's right, and I think that in these last days before the election, it's just the case that Trump is having a harder time persuading Republicans to vote for him and having a harder time persuading independents in Wisconsin to want to support him. And Wisconsin has a registration advantage for Democrats in presidential election years, and so he has to win a turnout battle, and he doesn't have a lot of campaign offices in Wisconsin, especially as compared to Hillary Clinton. And so the get-out-the-vote operation is starting from behind, which is not the position you want to be in when you're already behind, which he is has been in Wisconsin for several months.
Mike Wagner is with us right now from the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication, and we're talking about the impact candidate visits to swing states can have on voters. And we talked about Donald Trump. Let's talk about Hillary Clinton. And on that flip side, Hillary Clinton hasn't visited the state since the primary. She was slated to visit here with Barack Obama after she clinched the nomination. Then the Pulse nightclub shooting happened and they decided to hold off, but she hasn't been back since. What does that signal to voters in the state, if anything?
Well, you know, it's unique that a major party nominee is not in Wisconsin. I think it's a signal that Donald Trump knows Wisconsin is a state he would really need to win, I think, if he wants a path to 270 electoral votes. Hillary Clinton thinks that she has Wisconsin fairly comfortably, or she would be here a lot more than she has been, which is, you know, not since the primaries. And so I think if we see a Hillary Clinton visit near the end, we could interpret that as her thinking perhaps the election has gotten closer than she would hope, or perhaps she's on a swing through other areas and wanted to stop to at least have one visit to make sure that she was exciting the base to help promote them to turn out.
So early on, before we were where we are today, there was a lot of talk about the importance that Wisconsin could have as a swing state. And it seems as though during the course of the election, that image of Wisconsin as a swing state cooled off. Do you get the sense that maybe we are a little more swingy right now?
I don't know that the state is more swingy. The polls that I've seen all suggest a lead for Hillary Clinton. Clinton has a lead in terms of kind of the fundamentals of elections in Wisconsin. The president is pretty popular in Wisconsin, which helps candidates in an open seat election like we have now. And so Clinton's strategy seems to be a sensible one, given the kind of the lay of the land in the state. You know, it's possible that some Wisconsinites could say, well, gee, I'd sure like the nominee to come visit our state. But it's hard to imagine a Democrat saying, you know what, she never came to visit, I'm not voting for her.
And she's got her surrogates who have been here. We've seen Chelsea Clinton a couple times. Bernie Sanders will be here again tomorrow.
Right.
Do you think that is enough? I mean, after all, she did it, as you pointed out, she lost the primary to Bernie Sanders in Wisconsin. Maybe Democratic faithful would rather see Bernie Sanders in Wisconsin but still vote for Hillary Clinton.
I think it would be more exciting for the more liberal Democratic voters to see Sanders come and endorse Hillary Clinton than perhaps seeing Clinton herself. And it's also the case, yes, with Chelsea Clinton, who might appeal to younger voters, and of course the you know, number two on the ticket, Tim Kaine, also coming. It's not like Hillary Clinton's ignoring Wisconsin, but she hasn't visited in the general election, and she's not airing nearly as many ads here. Wisconsin is one of the few states where Donald Trump has an advantage in the number of ads he's aired his campaign as compared to hers.
What does that tell you about the campaigns themselves if you just look specifically at the advertising buys?
First, Clinton was much more strategic in terms of when she bought. It's usually cheaper to buy ads early, even if you want to play them later, and she did that around the country and saved a lot of money doing that. A lot of the money that's coming in now is more expensive to purchase. And so, you know, you see a lot of stories saying Donald Trump is spending lots of money on ads, but he's spending more per ad than Clinton had to when she made her buys a long time ago. And so I think she was more strategic with how she spent her money and is getting a more bigger bang for her buck in terms of her advertising dollar.
We're talking with Mike Wagner right now. He's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And he's with us to talk about the impact candidate visits to swing states can have on voters.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is it important that presidential candidates visit the state? Are you more inclined to vote for a candidate if they swing through your home state? And are you swayable at this point? Have you already voted? If you haven't, are you still up for grabs? What would sway you one way or another? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation about how much of an impact a presidential candidate's visit can have on voters, especially in swing states like Wisconsin.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you appreciate candidate visits to your home state? Why? If not, what would you prefer the candidates do to get your vote? What are you still looking for from them? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're continuing our conversation with Mike Wagner. He's an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Mike, talking about some breaking news as of Friday, that is, Clinton's campaign taking the impact from news that broke last Friday that the FBI is looking into her emails after it found what it calls relevant emails in an unrelated investigation. Hillary Clinton gave a brief news conference about this last week where she did call on the FBI to address these emails quickly and transparently. How would you gauge how this could be affecting her campaign and the race in general?
Well, I think that for people who've made their decision and for people who, you know, either like Hillary Clinton or don't like Hillary Clinton, all this information does is reinforce their pre-existing attitudes. If you don't like Clinton, this is just another example that the scandals are never going to end in your view. And if you like Clinton, it's just another example of how an unrelated investigation leads to something where there's never a charge and never a guilty finding and just another scandal. For people who are in the middle, since it's about something we've already heard a ton about and since it's really confusing, how many emails are we talking about? Whose emails are they? Why do we care about them? What might be in them? She didn't seem to send them. She didn't seem to receive them. I don't know that this is something that sways voters. It's not really new information. It's more of the same without giving us any kind of clear-cut resolution that we can hang our hat on to make a decision if you're somebody who's on the fence.
It is close to election day, but it seems that the presidential election runs in cycles. So we just had a really big cycle looking at allegations of sexual harassment with Donald Trump, and that was a conversation for a long time. And now it seems as though this is the cycle, looking at the email conversation again, has unexpectedly flared up. So going into election, I mean, as part of it, and this is something that 538.com has talked about, is it just the disadvantage for the candidate who has the negative story in the news right before election?
I think if the election is really close, that's possible, because any movement in a half a percentage point one way or the other could really affect the outcome. Right now, most aggregated pollsters who look at a wide variety of polls and come up with some kind of average have Clinton up somewhere between 3 and 7 points, depending upon which of the aggregators you like best. Those are fairly comfortable leads, and in some cases, we would think of a Trump comeback as nearly historic, given how far he was behind just a week ago.
Let's take a caller now. We have Josiah with us in Fort Atkinson. Josiah, hi.
Hi. About your question, I think it doesn't really matter that a candidate visit our state, because, first of all, they're going to run their program no matter what, and giving the state extra attention in the campaign doesn't exactly mean that it'll give extra attention during their term in office, as well as I think a lot of the aesthetic to be able to see the candidate in our state is more of a celebrity thing rather than actually hearing some concrete evidence, as previously pointed out, or
Thank you so much for your thoughts. Appreciate that. Josiah saying it doesn't matter that much just because they're here doesn't mean they're going to be especially looking out for Wisconsin. Obviously, they have a whole nation to govern. What do you think about that?
Well, there is a little bit of evidence that presidents think about swing states a little bit more under particular circumstances when they're governing. And one of those is, for example, disaster relief. And, you know, this seems like almost an amazing and almost depressing research finding, but that in states where they're up for grabs, usually in presidential election seasons, presidents are quicker to declare disasters after tornadoes, hurricanes, things like that. And so presidents do give a little bit of extra attention. They often try to court the lawmakers from those states, give them rides on Air Force One, but not just that kind of stuff, but also working on policies that those folks care about. There's a little bit of evidence to that, but I think the caller is right. The president is the president of everybody, not the president of just Wisconsin or just the swing states. And so these visits aren't, I don't know that they're persuading voters. They probably are reminding early voters, get to the polls and bank them. The candidates are very aggressive about doing that in early voting states like ours. And so there are some effects, but I think the caller is on to quite a bit in his comments.
Josiah, thanks a lot. And we're going to move next to Joe joining us from Menasha. Joe, hi.
Yeah, so I don't mean to like toot my own horn here, but I feel a little bit like I'm stuck in the Yeats poem, The Second Coming. You know, best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. I don't even know what to think anymore. I mean, this thing has become so offensive to me. Trump has denuded the election process of all decency and sometimes common sense, not to mention facts, while Hillary just is the most unappealing person to run for president since I can't remember. And so I like Hillary's ideas and her intellect, but personally, she just seems to not have any political instinct at all, and so she gets torn apart for it.
And Joe, let me ask you before we let you go, are you still going to vote given all that?
Oh, I'm going to vote. I mean, it's critical that we vote. I think we're making a very distinct differential in the decision here. I mean, there are huge differences between these two. And I'll probably vote for Hillary just because, I mean, it's not a popularity contest at the end of the day. This
Joe, thank you so much. I want to make sure our guest Mike can weigh in on this. And Mike, I love that he quoted Yeats. He's really feeling
right.
It. That was soulful.
Well,
he really doesn't understand what this election is about.
I think Joe is articulating what a lot of undecided voters feel, which is disgust toward Donald Trump, but not quite liking Hillary Clinton for one reason or another. And that is a place where people see themselves. And in that sort of environment, we would expect Clinton to have a small lead. And that's what she has.
All right. And Mike, you know, looking ahead just briefly, what do you think about where we stand? So we're a week out. It used to be the October surprise was the big surprise. Now we have these emails and no one can call this election cycle. It seems like it's uncallable. But do you think that there could still be significant movement in the last week of the election? And if so, what kind of bellwethers are you looking for, just briefly?
Well, I think we should expect the election to get a little bit closer. It tends to whenever we approach Election Day. We should expect partisans who are wavering to be more likely to vote for their party than the other party. So we should certainly look to see if Trump is able to consolidate his voters. I think those are places to look. But, you know, 4 years ago, Barack Obama was up less than one percentage point in most of the aggregate polls. Hillary Clinton's up by far more than that now. Obama won fairly comfortably. And so while on the one hand it's been a wild year, on the other hand, Clinton is leading in the fundamentals fairly comfortably despite some negative news cycles.
And what's your best guess about how much Wisconsin will matter?
I think that Wisconsin is less of a swing state than it has been in years past. I think we're seeing that in the lack of attention in terms of advertising from the Clinton campaign and the, you know, comparatively little advertising we've seen overall. And I think we've seen that in terms of just the lack of visits. Even Trump has spent less than 10% of his time here since the Republican National Convention. And this is a state he really needs to win. So I think Wisconsin, if Wisconsin gets really, really close, that's a sign that the election has gotten really, really close. And so I think we'll all be watching that Marquette Law poll tomorrow.
Mike, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's Mike Wagner, an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And he joined us there to talk about candidate visits to swing states and how these visits influence, maybe the absence, how they affect voters.
Wisconsin's only open congressional seat is the 8th District in the northeastern part of the state. Incumbent Republican Reid Ribble decided not to seek a third term this year. The Democrat in the running is a longtime politician who served in the state assembly and is now the Outagamie County executive. Patty Murray joins us with this profile of Tom Nelson.
Tom Nelson is a lanky 40-year-old whose day job has long been in politics. When he ran his first campaign a dozen years ago, Nelson's personal circumstances were simpler. Now that he's looking to take the next step to Congress, Nelson is married with two little kids. He told a crowd at a recent campaign rally that the idea of a congressional campaign was not initially popular in his house.
Back in February, so when Congressman Ribble said he wasn't going to run, I turned to my wife, Maria, and I asked her what she thought. And before I could say anything, she said no.
A lot has changed since then. Nelson's wife and kids were by his side when he officially announced his campaign for Congress from the family living room this spring. By fall, he was at his Green Bay campaign office, rallying volunteers, employing a slogan he uses a lot and the crowd knew by heart.
This is the most important election of our lifetime.
Since 2011, Nelson has worked as the Outagamie County Executive. Before that, from 2005 to 2011, he was in the State Assembly for three terms. In the fall of 2007, he gained national attention by camping out in the Assembly Chamber to protest a budget impasse. It was seen as grandstanding by some, but earned him points with his fellow Democrats, like State Senator Dave Hansen.
I think he'd be a great congressman, no question.
Hansen has gotten to know Nelson through their time as fellow lawmakers. He says the campout was in earnest.
Someone with a lot of courage that understood that budget should be passed and we should move forward. And he fought really, really hard. And some people could say he won the argument. But you stand up for what you believe in. And he's always been able to do that.
You don't think that was a publicity stunt?
No, I think he believed it in his heart.
In some ways, Tom Nelson is a throwback. His favorite authors include John Steinbeck and Jack Kerouac. And he says family and a deep faith are his motivating factors in running for Congress. Nelson's political role model is his father, who never ran for anything. Instead, he was a Lutheran pastor who began a church in the Fox Valley.
And he started his church the old-fashioned way. He went door-to-door, talking to future parishioners, talking to members of the community about his faith, about his beliefs.
It was a formative experience to the then 4-year-old Tom Nelson. He says he came to learn of a connection between his father's grassroots ministry and politics.
I use that as a starting point because it was at a very young age that I understood the importance of service. My dad found that in the ministry. I found it in public service.
All that door-knocking experience came in handy when he made his first assembly run.
24 years later, I found myself walking the same blocks, knocking on the same doors that my dad did 24 years ago. And there were quite a few people. Every week, someone would remember or recall a memory when my dad knocked on their door 20 years before that.
To hear Nelson tell it, family is his number one priority, with church a close second. But his passion for politics and public service are driving him to try to take the 8th Congressional District back from the Republicans. And he has faith he will. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.